KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening hour of Forum, sociologist Amitai Etzioni joins us to talk about racialization in America, particularly through the use of Hispanics as a racial category. And we'll also talk with him about the communitarian movement. He's been a leader in that for years. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Amitai Etzioni joins us this hour. He's the author of 22 books, including My Brother's Keeper. He's also former president of the American Sociological Association and the International Society for the Advancement of Socioeconomics. He was professor of sociology and department chair for a number of years at Columbia University, as well as a guest scholar with the Brookings Institution and senior advisor to the White House. Also, Thomas Henry Carroll Ford Foundation professor at the Harvard Business School and is presently professor of sociology and international affairs at George Washington University School of International Affairs. He is also the founder of the Communitarian Network, and he joins us for this morning's opening hour of Forum. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Delighted to be there. Can I add that I'm a proud graduate of Berkeley?
You most certainly can. And the weather in Washington is very similar to what you remember of Berkeley's fine weather.
Indeed.
Well, I read your paper in the Nieman Report, and we're hearing so much about the influence of Hispanics and Hispanic numbers, and particularly Hispanics in politics, most powerful political group and so forth. And from what I read, you're troubled by this whole definition as well as the dissemination of the idea that there is a Hispanic category.
That's very true. Even more important is, what is that category? There is some attempt to, what they say, to racialize, to turn the Hispanics into a race. Or we can treat them as a kind of a conglomeration of ethnic groups, like the way we have Polish and Italian and Irish Americans, we're going to have Mexican and Cuban Americans. And it makes a huge difference if we're going to end up thinking about them as a race or thinking about them as a group of ethnic groups, because we tend to, though a social scientist would not agree, think about race as kind of a biologically given. You're born to a race and you have features which everybody can recognize, and they are unchangeable. And it's a sort of division and sense of victimhood and exploitation. But ethnic groups is just all Americans belong to one ethnic group or another. So the more we think about Hispanics as a race, the more divisive we become, the more we think about them as an ethnic group, the more they become integrated in our concept. Now, somebody might say, well, this is just, you know, labeling. And first of all, labels make a difference, but this goes way beyond labeling. It goes to allocation of funds, the minority set-asides. It goes to admission to colleges. So these categories influence our thinking and our actual behavior.
It's a category that is so wide and inclusive. I mean, as you point out, there is a Latino Legends team in baseball, for those who know baseball, and you've got Roger Clemens and Jackie Robinson together linked as Hispanics. In fact, from what I'm reading in your work on the census, there's this other category, and about 6.75 million Americans designate themselves as others. 80% of those were, that is, 80% of Hispanics chose that.
Exactly. Actually, I'm one of those. I don't want to be racially defined, not white or anything else. The census used to allow you to do that by saying other. But that got under a lot of political pressure from groups who lose money that way, because if you buy out from a racial category, they get less money. So during the Clinton years, we dropped that category, and you no longer can do that. The census now insists that you define your race. But it's important detail. You see, we rely in this country on a person telling you what race they are. we're not telling you as a government, as a society, we tell you what you are. That's what the Nazis did. That's what the Deep South used to do. If you had one drop of black blood, they said you're black. We dropped all that. Nevertheless, if you look at any of the tables, you see, just to give you one example, the Wall Street Journal on October 10, 2 days ago, has a table where they talk about white, blacks, Asian, and Hispanics. So clearly, they treat it as if it was a fourth race. And then if you look at the tiny, tiny footnote, it says that the whites are non-Latino whites. This is one of those very complicated formulas to get out of that box. But the simple fact is that half of the Latinos, Hispanics, Americans consider themselves white. And I don't think it's appropriate or in line with our tradition for other people to come and say to them, no, I don't think you're white, I think you're brown. It's just very much in conflict with our new, much more progressive society.
Well, Richard Rodriguez, who I'm sure your work you're familiar with, wrote a book called Brown and certainly identified himself as being brown. But you're talking about a category that includes, let's say, generations that go down to back to conquistadores and Guatemalan Indians and Sephardic Jews. I mean, these all come under the Hispanic category.
Yeah, now it's perfectly all right for somebody to say that they're brown, but it's not all right for me to say that they're brown because everybody's entitled to define themselves. That's our whole concept. It's just if somebody wants to pass, let's assume they're African-American who wants to pass and declares that they're white. Some people on both sides of the line may think that's not a very cool behavior, but we're certainly not going to say to them, you cannot do that. And here we come to the largest growing group of Americans and beginning to tell them increasingly that, no, you cannot. You think you're, half of you think you're white. We will not accept it. And I think that's unfortunate. It's not in line with our recent traditions, and it's unfortunate for the society.
Talking with sociologist Amitai Azioni, and I guess Hispanic was first used back in 1980, but your concern here as a sociologist is that origin is perhaps weighed more than achievement, that the government still racializes as a result of that.
That's very true. By the way, I should remind the listeners that the difference among Hispanics are at least as large as the difference between among various Hispanics, let's say Cuban-Americans and Mexican-Americans. The difference at least as large as between Hispanics, let's say, and other groups. Cuban-Americans tend to be Republican, tend to be very patriotic. All of them try to be, practically all of them trying to become American citizens. Mexicans tend to lean more to the democratic liberal side. Many of them do not intend to become American citizens. They want to make some money and go back to Mexico. There's a world of difference between these two groups, and to treat them as if they were the same is just misleading. And therefore, the merit is to go back to the model we use otherwise. Otherwise, we talk regularly about Polish, Irish, Swedish Americans, and I don't see any reason we should treat the Hispanic any difference.
In other words, everybody could hybridize their identity in terms of their origins.
Exactly. And then we get the Tiger Woods. I love the Tiger Woods Americans, which you find in my own family. My late wife was Mexican. My children are half Mexicans and half whatever I am. And so they are moving very rapidly to society in which the hyphens become so complicated, become unimportant. Like Tiger Woods has four hyphens. What we're going to see is there's a 45% intermarriage rate. Between Latinos and others. I want to emphasize this because we measure sociologists how close people get to each other. Are they willing to work together? Do they mind if somebody from the other group lives next door? But nothing is more intimate, more binding, more connecting than marriage. And if you get 45% of Hispanics marrying non-Hispanics, that shows you how quickly they become integrated in this American society. And that's, from a social cohesion viewpoint, a very, very constructive development. And we shouldn't try to slow it down by starting labeling them as a distinct race.
talking about Hispanic identity and racialization, ethnic identity with sociologist Samantha Etzioni, and I'm sure that many of you who are listening will want to weigh in here, but as long as I have Professor Etzioni on the phone here for this hour, I also wanted to talk with you about the communitarian movement, which you've been involved in for years, because I think listeners certainly would be interested, and this has been, well, a passion of yours. The idea having a good deal to do with community and with the ideal of community and balancing liberty and social order and creating a good society based on the balance between liberty and social order. Give us a little more of the outlines of what you're talking about here. It begins to sound a bit utopian, frankly.
Well, there are people who think about the United States. Let's just start with the facts before we talk about what I think is desirable. That people think about the United States as if there were 300 million individuals. But it ain't so. Our vague, important part of our life, even today, is exercised in various communal groups. So, for instance, there is a gay community. And it's very important in the life of gay people. They don't necessarily all live in the same space. Often they do. But, for instance, if a gay person from San Francisco will go to New York, he will know exactly what neighborhood to go to find other people who share his orientation. He will probably know some of the leaders. He will find very soon personal connection. The same would hold. And for instance, one of the interesting stories in California is the Cambodian Americans decided for some reason to go into donut making. So if you come now from Cambodia, you will be very likely to go and link up with other Cambodian Americans. They will help you learn English. They help you find a job. Jews are coming from Russia, the Jewish community. This has been the long American tradition that we have a lot of social services, a lot of mutual help societies, saving associations, all based on ethnic, religious, sometimes communities. And we continue in this tradition very much. There are other sorts of community. There are intellectual communities. I mentioned earlier Berkeley, where people live together because they kind of have an affiliation of a campus. There are professional communities. Many of the doctors kind of in a community hang out together. But the notion of community is dead, that there is no longer what Putnam called social capital, I think is simply contradicted by the facts. So I don't have to reinvent community. I just can extol its merit and point out that it's part of our nature that when we are individualized, we really suffer. There's a very important study done in Manhattan in the high-rise buildings where people are isolated. People live there for 30 years, and they don't know their person next door, and they barely say hello to each other in the elevator. And you find a very high incidence of mental illness and depression and such, because people are, that's why I call my book The Brother's Keeper. We are bonded to each other, and when these bonds are destroyed, we suffer.
Well, you mentioned Bob Putnam and social capital. His whole notion is that we're bowling alone, that we become more and more broken from community, and you see evidence very contrary to that.
Not only I do, but Putnam does. Anybody who read the book knows it's a very, very clever title, which obviously contributed to the success of the book. But Putnam does not claim that there ever was a single person who bowled alone. What he claims is that we move from being members of formal leagues of bowling to much more informal social groups of bowling. And then there's a big debate if that's true or not. For instance, some people say it's true that the PTA membership is declining, but a new, different kind of association of parents and teachers. But that's a very big controversy in social science. But Putnam does not argue that we bowl alone. Nobody bowls alone. It's even hard to imagine. So there's a shift in the way our fabric exists. And it's true. There are some bedrooms communities of commuters who just come home to sleep and they go back to work in the city. But by and large, where you don't have bonding, there's, by any measure we know, people are less happy, have more illnesses. What more can I say on behalf of the community?
Well, let me ask you about, you mentioned PTA membership declining, right. And I think that Putnam does argue that there's been a decline in community.
Right.
The role of schools, you say, is to develop a moral self and remedy moral development. Those certainly could be interpreted as being loaded statements. What do you mean?
Well, I have now lots of grandchildren, and so when I go with them to visit their preschool, the line which I hear again and again, and I love it, is use your words. What does it mean? It means any time two of the kids are starting to shove each other or hit each other, the teacher rushes and says, use your words. What's happening here? Children are taught very early in the United States that using force, using violence, pushing people, shoving people is morally unacceptable, and that you have to learn that the right way to behave is discuss things. Then by the time they come to kindergarten, they're already made to sit down and solve, have conferences, talk things out. In first grade, we then very soon get to corridor mentors, so that there's an enormous effort goes into what is called human development. But really, character formation is to teach people to be civil to one another, to solve differences in a peaceful manner, which is, well, that's one example. To take a very different example, the public schools like to pretend that they don't teach values. But you go to any of the schools, even in the early grades, and they drill into children respect for the environment. What is that? That is a moral commitment we have to Mother Earth, and they go and they measure the dirt in the streams and whatever they do. But the message is unmistakable that we owe things. We have a moral obligation to the environment. Now, you, God forbid, will say anything which is a racial slur in any of our schools, and there'd be no end to the discussion, to the principal office. What is that again? We teach our young, as of course we should, that we are all God's children. We are all deserve human dignity, and that defining people by race and slurring them is just unacceptable, morally unacceptable behavior. And then we have some things we don't agree about. Patriotism, some people think it's inappropriate, some people think it's essential, and people define it differently. So it's true, we don't agree on all value issues, but the schools are knee-deep in character development issue. I beseech your listeners to tell me, how would you teach the civil rights movement as a neutral subject without obviously being on the side of the social change? How would you teach the Betty Friedan and the feminist movement without talking about how we ought to deal with people of another gender? So the school text cannot but deal with character and moral issues.
We're talking to Amitai Etzioni. Back to how we deal with the racial issue that you raised about Hispanics. There are many examples that you've used about journalists. Play a very significant role in this. What can journalists, or what should journalists be doing?
I think we should drop racial categories altogether and use instead country of origin or ethnic characterizations, where we need to talk about differences. So they're European Americans, and they would include people from Spain. They are Latinos or South American Americans. They're African Americans. And we can divide them more deeply. We can talk about Caribbean American, depending on your need, or country by country, the way we do so often, Mexican American, Cuban American, Polish Americans. But the moment we move from races to use country of origin and ethnic groups, we move away from that notion that there are sharp dividing lines, and we move to recognize that we all have a hyphen, and that the hyphens are quickly eroding to just make us Americans.
I don't mean to be facetious here, but, you know, you have, let's say, a Rhodesian white who would technically be an African-American.
Right.
And you also have people who come from so many different national backgrounds, I mean, who move around and have that kind of mobility where they have many, many antecedents in terms of their own backgrounds.
This is a very fair point. There is no classification system in which, almost by definition, since you want to deal with millions of people in the category, you will not find exceptions. Let's go to black and white. Everybody thinks they don't know what that means. Well, recently, the University of Pennsylvania, the sociology class, asked its students to volunteer to submit to a DNA test. And turns out that many of the white students had 40 or 50% genes which suggest there was some black background in their history, and many of the black Americans had some white in them. So the notion that we can have pure categories is exactly the notion I want to move away from. And as to your last point, I couldn't agree more. People move around. We should downgrade the definition of where they're coming from and upgrade the definition where they're going to. I'd much rather characterize a person as trying to become a ballet dancer or an engineer or a nuclear physicist rather than where they came from or what their parents' race was.
And the Census Bureau on the score, what should they be looking at or doing?
Again, if they should look at country of origin, they should look at ethnicity, and they just should dump the racial category. That goes, by the way, of course, immediately to the question of social justice in admission. Of course, it's a big debate, should we use race in admissions or not? I believe we should use your total social background. So, for instance, if there's a black billionaire whose child is competing against the child of a poor Appalachian white, I don't think we should automatically assume that the black billionaire's child should get a privilege or priority. So we should take into account your total social background, including whatever injustices were done to your parents or grandparents, but we should not mechanically take race as the determining factors, and the courts happen to agree with me on that, or the other way around, I should say. I agree with the courts.
Well, your Nieman Report paper, you say that the effects of this Hispanic category, quote, creates a divide rather than space.
Exactly. By the way, I should add one other thing, which can, there's a very deep change occurring in American society, which we begin to allude to, but we haven't begun to come to terms with it. They're so used to think in terms of black and white that we simply haven't quite absorbed the fact, maybe you guys did, but not much of the country, that the African-American community is growing much more slowly than the Hispanic community, which its number already exceeded that of African-Americans. And in the near future, we're going to talk much more about white Hispanic than of white black, especially as about a third of the blacks have become middle class, and they in many ways behave very much like other middle class people. So there's this whole sense of victimhood and injustice and discrimination, and all these issues are going to become less central. And our relationship with Hispanics who came here, because most of them at least, because they wanted to, who nobody brought them in chains, is going to make for a whole different tone in the most important lines which exist in American society. And by and large, a wholesome change.
We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with sociologist Samantha Azzioni, the founder of the Communitarian Movement and presently professor of sociology and international affairs with the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. We welcome your calls, and in fact, let me give out the phone number and invite you to join us in this discussion, not only about Hispanics and racial categories, ethnic categories, and what they ought to be and what they are, but also talking about the Communitarian Movement, which has certainly gotten a lot of attention through the years since it was founded by Amitai Azzioni. We welcome your involvement, and you can join us now, whether you're listening to us on radio, Internet, or Sirius Satellite. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email any questions or comments you have to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. This is KQED, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this opening hour with Amitai Azzioni, who is professor of sociology and international affairs at George Washington University, the author of My Brother's Keeper and some 20 other books, well-known as the founder of the Communitarian Network and former senior advisor to the White House, speaking of which we'll be talking next hour with Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist who was also an advisor to President Clinton. Professor Azzioni, my producer, who's African-American, wanted you to know, just for the record, that Forbes list has only two black billionaires, Bob Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, and Oprah Winfrey, for I guess, future reference. We're going to go to our callers here. Before I do, though, when you were talking about teaching morality to kids, I couldn't help thinking about another paper of yours I read where you talk about this global divide, and it's a global divide as you see it between those who believe in coercion and those who believe in persuasion.
From my viewpoint, there couldn't be nothing more important. This whole debate we have now about terrorism, about Islam and such, we completely disregard those of us who talk about a clash of civilizations, that in all cultures, in all religious and secular belief systems, from civil rights movement to socialism to Hinduism to Judaism to Christianity, there have always been two camps. Those who believe that when you are right, you're called upon to go and force other people to accept your beliefs, which you call jihad or crusaders or whatever. And there are others who believe it's a terrible wrong thing to do, that you should convince other people. There's a line in Quran which says there's no compulsion in Islam. And that divide tells us where our allies lie. We disregard the fact that most Muslims in Indonesia, most Muslims in Bangladesh, and in many other countries are really on the non-violent side. They very much are not liberals. They're not necessarily in favor of democracy. Some of them don't even believe in human rights. But they do not want to force us or anybody to accept their beliefs. If we're only going to ally ourselves with those who accept an American definition of liberty and democracy, we're not going to have many friends or allies. If we're going to ally ourselves with all those who abhor violence, we're going to find that most of the Islamic world is on our side. I'm not just saying this from the depths of sociological theory and studies. I was a guest of the reformers in Iran, some of the best 10 days in my life. They think that every one of them, well, I didn't talk to all of them, of course, but all the leaders I met with, all the intellectuals I met with, said one the same thing. They do not want a secular society. They want a Muslim religious society, but in which people will come to pray because they want to pray and not because somebody forces them to pray. But that is the dividing line. Why should we oppose people who want to preach their views? That's what we call free speech. And then we'll preach ours, and let's see who will be more compelling. But we do not want people to be shot because they have a different viewpoint.
Let me bring in our callers and find out what their viewpoints are. David, you're first up here. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling. I have a couple of points, well, more than a couple. First of all, the comment about Mexicans going back to Mexico and the Cubans staying here in the United States, the Cubans can't go back. They're here for good. They can't swim across the ocean to go back to Cuba, so they're stuck here even if they wanted to go back. And then you can't compare 1 million Cubans to 25 million Mexican-Americans. It's ridiculous. I mean, there's so few of them compared to Mexican-Americans. And so when it comes to numbers, I think that should be taken into account. The other thing, Hispanics, I being one of them, will never assimilate. Not because we don't want to, but because there are two giant cultures next to each other, the Anglo-Saxon and the Hispanic culture, both about 300 million people each. They can't destroy each other. They will never assimilate. Let's say someone like from Italy, an Italian-American, he can, because Italy is not next door. So you don't have 300 million Italians next to the United States who can actually feed the Italians who live here. But in the case of Latin America, that's what's happening all the time.
Let's get some response from Professor Etzioni.
Well, about the first point, I couldn't agree more, and it gives more support to the little point it's trying to make. I think it's ridiculous to treat Cuban Americans and Mexican Americans as if there were no important difference among them. And David just added some more important differences in their numbers, in the fact that Cubans at the moment cannot go home. So whatever the reason, the historical reason is, they're very, very different. And so mechanically call them all one thing is just not sociologically wrong and policy-wise not helpful. Assimilation is a tricky term. If assimilation means you're all going to blend into one mold without any differences, I very much agree this is not going to happen. But the notion, what happens within each community, within the American society, is that people become kind of double. This is this hyphen idea, that we are all Americans, and then we have various ethnic backgrounds, Cuban, Mexican, Americans. And there's an interesting little detail which makes this clarify what I'm trying to say. At one point, there was a question if Hispanic Americans would have to fight if we would invade Panama, because after all, these are other Hispanic Americans. And the answer is unmistakable. If you are an American, whatever your background, when we're at war, just or unjust, you can go and choose whom you're going to fight. So this comes to illustrate that on some issues, we are going to be all members of one community, and on other issues, we'll continue to differ. So if assimilation means you all blend into one stew, no. Yeah, I think the word integration is better. We are being integrated in one larger whole while maintaining our difference, our pluralism within that context.
There's still a kind of myth of the melting pot, though, isn't there?
Right, but the melting pot always was the wrong image because, again, it was the idea that we're all going to melt down our differences. But in effect, we always tolerated their hyphens.
And we'll get to more of your calls. Mike, join us. Morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the conversation. An interesting thought that I have, I've had the fortune of traveling all over the world, and I've been to 42 countries, which is not common for most Americans. One of my favorite places in the world is Cuba, because Cuba has culture. They have a community. The one thing that brings people from all over the world to America is they can come here and still celebrate their culture. You know, I am from Italy, I am from Ireland. Well, the Americans don't really get to say that because they're from America, and the culture that is American is we work hard, we make money, we take care of our families, and we live our lives. So, you know, what does it mean to be American? It means that we're proud of our country, but what does it mean to be Latin, or what does it mean to be Irish, or what does it mean to be Cuban? Those people still celebrate those traditions in America. And I think that the assimilation of that is bringing the life of their culture and having it in America and enjoying all the benefits that America has. So that, what do you think about that?
We are richer for it. So we added salsa to our music, into our food. Used not to have the kind of Mexican dishes. We now have Tex-Mex all over the place. Our cuisine has become richer. Cinco de Mayo, most Americans have no idea what that is. It
right.
becomes increasingly celebrated by non-Mexican Americans. So we have one more interesting holiday. The Vicavanza is added to the list. I can go on and on.
Right.
Our life is... Each ethnic group brings us something. The Jews brought a certain kind of comedy. Each one brings us something. And as a result, our whole has become more varied, more interesting, more innovative. Again, I can go group by group, what Asian Americans
yeah.
bring and so on,
right.
To show that that's, in effect, one of our greatest strengths. Let me not mislead here. There are many problems this country has, and some of them I tell you in Washington. But on this issue, on how we learn to deal with people of different countries of origin, we are light years ahead of the Europeans, for instance, and we should be proud of it.
And let me thank Mike for his call. Here's a sociologist who sends the following email. She says, I agree with Amitai Etzioni that Hispanics are not a racial group. However, the census no longer includes Hispanic as a racial group. It now first asks whether a person is Hispanic or not. Then it asks a separate race question. And an important change in the most recent census is that it allows people to check more than one race. But in any case, the whole question of race certainly is socially constructed. There is no question about that. Look at the category Asian. It is just as meaningless as Hispanic. For example, how can one possibly lump Indians into the same group as Chinese? Furthermore, where are Pakistanis and Afghans supposed to fit into this scheme? Are they Asians too? None of this makes rational sense.
I couldn't agree more. Actually, there's an interesting detail here, how capricious this is. Indian Americans and Pakistani Americans were considered white by the census until, I think, about 20 years ago, roughly. And then the census decided by stroke of a pen or a click of a mouse that, no, they are Asians. And so suddenly the American Asian population increased by X millions and the white one decreased. This shows you how capricious the definitions are. In the last census, there was suddenly an enormous increase, I don't have the figures at my fingertips, of the number of Native Americans, of Indian Americans. So what happened, you ask? How could they increase so significantly? Well, the census decided that those from Central America and such who consider themselves of Indian origin, they should be counted in the same category as Native Americans. So this whole racial thing, I think the phrase my colleague used is very appropriate, are socially constructed. And that means also that they're not God-given or biologic-given. Means we can look at them and say, wait a moment, that's not a helpful definition. Let's use some other definition.
Well, here's another listener from Oakland named Vladi who says, I'd like to know what your guest thinks of American Jews who pass for or consider themselves as white, especially when it's convenient, and of those who consider Jews white. I've always thought this was an odd phenomenon exclusive to America.
I don't know that it's helpful to make more races. That's my whole point. And so, by and large, most people consider Jews an ethnic group and not a race. The Nazis, basically, the ones who claimed that Jews were a separate race.
No, there was a long time in American culture where
that's true.
Jews were considered darker people or another race, really. Yeah.
Together with Irish and Polish, which, by the way, it's a wonderful example how capricious the definitions are. 100 years ago, I couldn't agree with you more. Jews, Polish, and Irish were considered dark people. These days, Jews are considered practically by everybody an ethnic group. As to them passing one way or the other, the group considered this being disloyal, but this is very much part of the American way. I mentioned earlier that in the third generation, 45% of Hispanic Americans marry people who are not Hispanic. And there's a very similar figure for Asian Americans, and for Jews, the figure is 50%. So we're rapidly moving into society, and it would be impossible to tell people anymore. They'd be like Tiger Woods. They will have Filipino, Caribbean.
Calabasian, I think, is the word.
Yeah, but I like to call them all Americans.
By the way, if you would like to join us with Professor Amitai Etzioni, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And Deep, good morning.
Morning, Deep. Interesting program, very interesting as always. So, Michael, you are absolutely amazing with the kind of topics you come up with and your intimate knowledge of each issue. I want to just talk about, you know, what the British used to do in India about divide and rule between the Hindus and the Muslims and the Sikhs. And that's exactly what the the U.S. does with its different ethnicities and how it lets the blacks fight against the browns, against the yellows. And it's very interesting to see that in the political realm where the African Americans resent the Latinos and the Asian Americans piggybacking on the civil rights movement, the gay and lesbian movement. You know, so it is incredible how the 25% are squabbling with each other, ignoring the 75% who continue to dominate the polls. And society, and it's absolutely amazing how we spend all our time squabbling about ethnicities when we need to be keeping our eyes on the prize. That's why the White House is the White House.
Comment, Professor Etzioni.
Okay. Well, I don't know much about India, but one of the least often observed features of American politics is that we're really coming together and ignoring our racial backgrounds. So, for instance, the majority of the citizens of Washington, D.C. are African-Americans, but our mayor and our council members keep changing their races and their colors. Now, we are not electing, you would think there are up to 70% African-Americans here, we would have only black mayors. Far from it. Virginia is a state which is, quote, very white, and they had a black governor. New York City, which has a little of everything, had black mayors, had white mayors. Los Angeles, many of the Hispanics voted for white mayor. And now many whites vote for an Hispanic mayor. So this notion that ethnic groups act as a bloc, and if you have a majority of one ethnic group, that's what you're going to get in politics, it fortunately is not happening. People take into account your merits, your position, and not simply vote on the basis of ethnicity, and we are better for it.
When the political pundits, though, talk about the Hispanic vote and they use that, it may be kind of a floating signifier or something along those lines for essentially Latinos and people who come from Mexico and Latin America in large part, isn't it? I mean, especially they do analysis of President Bush and the Republicans trying to win over the Hispanic vote, it usually means south of our border, I think, doesn't it?
Well, it's true, but people who use this as a simple category have a surprise coming because the Hispanics or whatever you want to take, the Mexican-Americans or whatever, are not going to vote like one bloc. They are moving around as they become a more integrated American society. They have changed their voting patterns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the notion that people vote as one group on the basis of the ethnicity is just not compatible with the facts.
Yes, and yet, excuse me, Professor, because I was just thinking about the fact that there are certainly high numbers of African-Americans who vote Democratic, certainly many Republicans, but not significant in terms of the big numbers of those who do vote Democratic, and similarly with American Jews.
Well, on the African-American, you're right. Roughly 9 out of 10 vote Democrats. And on many of these issues, sadly, African-Americans are still separate precisely because we treat them so much as a race. Also, out-marriage, what we talked about earlier, there's so many Hispanic and Asian marry people of other backgrounds. The percentage for African-Americans is much lower. So they, in many ways, are a separate group, and I wish we could change it more quickly. But the other groups move around a lot. Each group has a statistical tendency. Jews were more democratic and so on and so on. But, you know, you had Polish and Irish and Italian-Americans moving around, the Reagan Democrats and so on and so on. Catholics voted against Kerry, many. So this is a fluid situation, as it ought to be. And the categories, anybody assumes a one-to-one correlation simply pays no mind to the facts. Yes, there are tendencies, but it's a big difference between tendency and assuming automatic that your pigmentation determines your vote.
Al, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. And I've enjoyed reading Dr. Antonelli's works over the years, and it's an honor to be able to ask him this question. Isn't it true that before 1492, the actual concept of racism didn't exist, and it had to be created as a reason to discriminate against Africans in order to promote the slavery? Isn't that the true doctor? Don't you think?
Well, first of all, thank you for calling, and I appreciate your comments. It's very important for a professor like me who pontificates about everything once in a while to say, I don't know. And I wish I could answer your question. I'm a sociologist and don't have enough historical preparation to tell you what happened in 1492 from that viewpoint. I'm sorry, I'll look it up, but I cannot answer at the moment.
Well, we thank you for the call, Al. One of the things that you have pointed out repeatedly, though, is that when it comes to racial differences, I mean, when we're talking about DNA and when we're talking about genetic structure, they're pretty minimal.
Exactly, but that's true. 99% of our DNA is same, and our blood is red, and so race is skin deep. But we can use these things, and if you start building them up, you can build them up, and if you realize that they're hindrance and are detrimental to our good future, we can slowly play them down.
Cynthia, good morning. Welcome to Forum. Cynthia, are you there?
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm very happy to be talking to Professor Etzioni or to have the opportunity to make a comment. Well, I'm going to put a chink in your wheel because I think that the issues that have come up around this conversation are very complex. Culture and society, the issues around culture and society are very complex. I'm of Hispanic descent, and I prefer to call it that, but I'm actually a Tejana from Texas. And it was commented earlier about the different groups that come from, you know, from Cuba, Mexico, and there as a whole, their continent is full of Latin Americans. And it used to be that in the United States, if you were Hispanic, you were not, there was one ribbon of Hispanic, I mean, mostly Mexican-American or of Mexican descent. Now we have many ribbons that of people that speak Spanish, and the whole world has changed, and everyone's moving around. I think people have to identify themselves. I really don't like census. I hate statistics and numbers because people are real. Of all cultures, we're real, and I think Americans as individuals identify themselves with, first, where they are in their country, if they're from here, America, and then they identify with the part that calls them to become a part of a culture. So assimilation is an old word, and it applied when the Europeans would come over and this country was being developed. It was developed in a way that it did discriminate, and so we have that issue that's always underlying how we describe different groups in this country. Racism, discrimination have held many people back, but we have a wealth of different cultures and individuals, even those that are poor. So we talk about the best of us, but we all have the potential to become best, and we have to, each individual and group has to identify its own.
What have you said that has put a chink in the wheel, to use your phrasing here?
Well,
I'm not sure I understand.
That I want to say that it's all right to talk about assimilating, but you have this issue of not being able to assimilate, not being able to be accepted by the white community, and the racism discrimination keeps you down and or restricted.
I think it's Professor Etzioni's considered opinion that at least legally and statutorily that's in decline. Institutionally, too. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Anything can be legal, but it has to be enforced, you see. And there's always this subtle way. There are always these subtle ways of people denying others their rights or even justice and fair treatment.
But it's true that we haven't reached the city on the hill or the Garden of Eden, the sociological perfection. But the issue, as Michael put it, is, what, are we moving in the wrong or right direction? Are we playing down these differences and we slowly overcoming them? Or are we falling back? And I think, yes, I would like to see more progress. That's why I read those articles, to have categories which allows us to move forward. But by and large, I think we're moving in the right direction. And again, comparison to what's happening in Europe, it should show us how far we have come compared to societies which usually lecture us, so like, you know, France and Britain and Germany and Scandinavia. Let me also say one thing we haven't had a chance to discuss. We don't have one identity. There are people who have multiple identities. So somebody can feel they part of them is Hispanic, part of them is a member of a labor union, part of them is a feminist, and in each one of those, they find a different grouping. So the feminists will go together with non-Hispanic feminists, and a member of the labor union will be a member with, again, non-Hispanic workers. And then in some other area, they may act as Hispanics. So again, the notion that our racial or ethnic definition is really the determining factor and everything else falls by the wayside is just not compatible with the facts. And keep saying it, which you didn't, but other people do, it's just not helpful.
Let me thank Cynthia. We'll get more of your calls on. We'll go to Des Moines, Iowa. James, listening to us on Sirius?
Yeah. Actually, I just think it's interesting. I've been noticing something while we've been talking here is that we have a term for Hispanics or something, you know, pretty much anybody south of the southern United States border, or, you know, Asian for anyone in the Pacific Rim, you know, that area. But then we say, you know, maybe, you know, something that they're searching for acceptance in the white community. Well, there's like this big hypocrisy, because what does white even mean? You know, then maybe I should call myself, to keep it even and to even things out, maybe I should call myself Irish American or a Polish American, you know, because in that sense, you know, Hispanic, you know, Spain could be, Spaniards could be connected to Europe. They're pretty much as white as anybody else. Or are they Hispanic because even the term Hispanic, you know, there's this kind of what does white mean type deal.
Well, it's an excellent question, and it brings us full circle. Earlier somebody mentioned that the census now says you can define yourself as having many races, but it no longer allows you to say, I don't want to be any of the above. I just want to be an American. Don't categorize me. Don't box me in. And I think it's unfortunate. We should be allowed, since we choose our race. If nobody comes and takes our blood or DNA and says the government tells you what you are. You fill out the questionnaire, the census, and you put down what you think. The way it's now written, you can say you're white, you can say you're black, you can say you're half white, half black, but you cannot buy out of the racial regime. That's very unfortunate, in some ways really deeply un-American.
I wish we had more time, especially because there are a lot of emails here, some of them which say there's still all kinds of invisible forms of racism and bigotry that exist, and some of them which are in strong agreement with Professor Etzioni, particularly from a number of Hispanic listeners who don't like that category and feel that it's maybe been overused. But I certainly want to thank you for the time you spent with us, Amitai Etzioni, and Professor of Sociology, author of My Brother's Keeper, as well as Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, as well as our interns, Barton Kreith, Elsa Chang, Leah Wellborn, Michael Fisher, Negar Gobadi, and Mary Trail. And remind you that another Hour of Forum is coming your way. We're going to talk with Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz in the hour ahead about globalization. And also remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300. Thanks to our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.